Practice Test 2, Part 3. In this part, you will hear three short segments from a radio program. The program is called Learning from the Experts. You will hear what three different radio guests have to say about three different topics. Each talk lasts about 2 minutes. As you listen, you may want to take some notes to help you remember information given in the talk. After each talk, you will be asked some questions about what was said. From the three answer choices given, you should choose the one which best answers the question according to the information you heard. Remember, no problems can be repeated. For problems 36 through 50, mark all your answers below. Do you have any questions? Now you will hear the first radio segment.
As we all know, animals use a variety of means to defend themselves. What you may not be aware of, though, is the fact that members of the plant kingdom also have their defense mechanisms. Andrew Hyatt investigates.
When a plant senses it is under attack, when a caterpillar takes a bite out of its leaf, for example, it reacts. What happens is that certain chemical compounds contained in the saliva of the caterpillar are recognized by the plant, which promptly activates some form of chemical defense. This could be a toxin which kills the caterpillar, or a substance that stops its ability to digest the plant. One species that is particularly good at defending itself is the tobacco plant. Its initial reaction is to produce toxins to kill the invading caterpillars. But should that fail, it has yet another defensive ploy up its sleeve. Biologist Marcia Diaz is here to tell us more. Marcia?
Hi, Andrew. Out in the Great Basin Desert of southwestern Utah, several biologists are conducting experiments into how tobacco plants defend themselves, both by warding off some kinds of insects and by attracting others. Both of these defense mechanisms involve the release of odor molecules undetectable to humans. In the first phase of the experiment, a number of tobacco plants were treated with synthetic pastes. These pastes had been produced from airborne chemicals collected from tobacco plants whose leaves were being attacked by hawk moth caterpillars, one of the tobacco plant's most voracious predators. When the pastes were spread onto other tobacco plants whose leaves were free from caterpillars, fully grown hawk moths flying near those plants were repelled before they even got a chance to lay their caterpillar eggs.
So what these findings suggest is that in cases where the tobacco plant is unable to kill off hawk moth caterpillars already on its leaves, it can at least protect itself and its neighbors from further attack by repelling the hawk moths that would otherwise lay more eggs.
That's right. And that's not the only line of defense against new hawk moth eggs being laid, as the team found out in the second phase of the experiment. This involved introducing new hawk moth eggs onto the leaves of the tobacco plant. When the hawk moth eggs were present on the plant's leaves, a predatory insect called Geocorus palens, which feeds on this kind of egg, was attracted. It seems that in response to the hawk moth eggs on its leaves, the plant emitted chemical compounds designed to attract this carnivorous insect so that it could devour the eggs. This strategy enables the plant to get rid of 90% of the hawk moth caterpillars by disposing of most of them before they even hatch. In effect, what the tobacco plant does is send out a message to the Geocorus palens in the form of a special chemical. The message conveyed by this kind of chemical is not just a straightforward, "Help, I'm under attack." It's much more complex, since it also communicates exactly what kind of pest is causing the damage. The plant can thus ensure the right kind of predator will come to its aid. This is an example of how, by emitting certain chemicals, plants are able to communicate with warnings, pleas for assistance, and even invitations.
So the plant is getting rid of an insect that poses a threat by enlisting the help of another insect. The latter knows that by responding to this cry for help, it will be rewarded with a satisfying meal. This mutually beneficial relationship illustrates how in nature, it's often a case of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Now you will hear questions 36 through 40. Number 36. Why did scientists choose the tobacco plant for their experiments? Number 37. What happened when scientists spread the paste onto the tobacco plants? Number 38. In what way do Geochorus palins protect tobacco plants? Number 39. According to the speakers, what is the tobacco plant able to do? Number 40. What does the experiment demonstrate about the relationship between plants and insects? Now you will hear the second radio segment.
Many people, it seems, are highly critical of their looks. We may hate our lumpy thighs, crooked teeth, or balding pates, but how objective can an individual really be about his own appearance? Rodney Beavis is here to help us answer this and other questions.
While it's true that many of us are dissatisfied with our looks, our self-judgments are in no way fixed. We all have days when we feel like an ugly duckling among swans. The good news is that the reverse is sometimes true, too. While such feelings can often be attributed to mood, more often than not, something called the contrast effect is at work. Psychologist Merrill Branna provides more insight.
Well, this term refers to the way an individual might feel less attractive around good-looking people and more attractive around the less good-looking. An obvious example would be the fashion photographer who works around models all day and is highly aware of his or her physical imperfections while on duty, but perfectly satisfied with his or her appearance in a more realistic environment. More often than not, though, we are unaware of the effect the appearance of others may be having on our own self-image. In one study, female subjects were exposed to subliminal glimpses of an attractive female. In other words, images of more attractive women were flashed at them for a fraction of a second, not long enough for the subject to be conscious that they'd seen the pictures. The subjects were then asked to rate how attractive they considered themselves to be. Another group was exposed subliminally to images of a less attractive female and were asked to rate themselves. Those who had seen the attractive image rated themselves lower than the other group.
So the subjects' self-images were directly affected by the attractiveness of the female they had been shown subliminally. It is also true that we tend to be more critical of our appearance at times of heightened self-awareness, when giving a speech, for instance.
It's completely normal to experience such feelings when being observed by a large number of people. However, there are some people who are never free of such feelings. These are people who wouldn't even contemplate leaving the house unless perfectly groomed. Individuals with this personality trait have a tendency to be particularly harsh when it comes to self-judgment. They compare themselves with very good-looking people exclusively and feel that they aren't up to scratch. This can lead both to depression and a lack of self-confidence. These people suffer from something known as public self-consciousness.
And the paradox here is that their efforts to look good generally mean that strangers view them as more attractive. So, as we have seen today, Our self-image can be affected by a variety of factors, both external and internal. And while it might be completely normal to be hard on ourselves in our self-appraisals, there are certain individuals who are excessively harsh. Now you will hear questions 41 through 45. Number 41. How does the contrast effect make us feel about our appearance? Number 42. According to Merrill Brana, what is one characteristic of the contrast effect? Number 43. What did the experiment involving the subliminal images show? Number 44. What is said about public self-consciousness? Number 45. According to the speakers, what opinion do outsiders generally have of people with high levels of public self-consciousness? Now you will hear the third radio segment.
One problem that has concerned environmentalists in recent years is the accelerated rate at which the world's ice is melting. New research has shed more light on what is happening. Jim Jenkins reports.
It has long been known that global warming is having an impact on the world's ice sheets. Greenhouse gas emissions are causing temperatures to rise. Ice is melting, and sea levels are rising. According to recent scientific research, melting ice in the Antarctic is adding large amounts of fresh water to the ocean, so much, in fact, that every year it could fill Scotland's Loch Ness 18 times over. Climate change expert Gail Adams tells us more.
Well, the study focused on the Antarctic ice sheet. This particular mass of ice is of interest to scientists as it contains about 70% of the world's fresh water. The data for this latest survey was gathered by two NASA satellites launched in 2002. As they orbited the Earth at an altitude of 310 miles, they maintained a distance of exactly 137 miles between them. This was necessary for them to be able to measure how the ice sheet affected gravitational pull. They then used the figures to calculate the mass of ice in various parts of the ice sheet. The findings indicate that the ice sheet is losing mass at a much faster rate than previously thought, about 36 cubic miles annually, in fact. This is sufficient to raise global sea levels by 0.4 millimeters per annum.
But until these new figures were released, wasn't the situation thought to be somewhat different?
It had previously been speculated that global warming would actually increase the amount of snow falling in the Antarctic. This would mean that the ice sheet would gain ice as the snow fell upon it, thus increasing its mass. Now it seems that this isn't the case. But while these new findings are cause for concern, it might be too early to be pressing any panic buttons. Some members of the scientific community feel that as the study has been of a relatively short duration, it might not, in fact, reflect the overall picture. In the opinion of one, Professor David Vaughan of the British Antarctic Survey, several decades of study would be necessary before we could identify an overall trend with any confidence. Many environmentalists, however, feel that this new study indicates that the problem must be addressed urgently. It has even been claimed that if all the ice in the Antarctic ice sheet were to melt, along with the Arctic and Greenland ice sheets, global sea levels would rise by an amazing 84 meters.
Responses to the study vary considerably, from those who feel a degree of caution is called for when interpreting the findings, to those who feel that the findings provide all the more reason for taking drastic measures immediately.
Now you will hear questions 46 through 50. Number 46. What makes the Antarctic ice sheet interesting to scientists? Number 47. What made it possible for the satellites to get the specific information needed? Number 48. According to the satellite data, how fast are global sea levels rising due to the melting of Antarctic ice? Number 49. Before this study, what had been expected to happen in the Antarctic? Number 50. Why has the study come in for some criticism?